existing endlessly reiterates guilt. It is none other than Sartre who has seen the connection between the autonomy of a work and an intention which is not conferred upon it, but it is own gesture towards reality. The work of art, he has written, does not have an end. There we agree with Kant, but the reason is that it is an end. The Kantian formula does not account for the appeal which resounds at the basis of each painting, each statue, each book. Footnote 8, text. If only remains to add that there is no straightforward relationship between this appeal and the thematic commitment of a work. Page 314. The uncalculating autonomy of works which avoid popularization and adaption to the market involuntarily becomes an attack on them. The attack is not abstract, not a fixed attitude of a work of art to the world which will not forgive them for not bending totally to it. The distance these works maintain from empirical reality is in itself partly mediated by that reality. The imagination of the artist is not a creation ex nihilo. Only dilettanti and aesthetes believe it to be so. Works of art that react against empirical reality obey the forces of that reality, which reject intellectual creations and throw them back on themselves. There is no material content, no formal category of an artistic creation, however, mysteriously changed and unknown to itself, which did not originate in the empirical reality from which it breaks free. It is this which constitutes the true relation of art to reality, whose elements are regrouped by its formal laws. Even the avant-garde abstraction which provokes the indignation of Philistines and which has nothing in common with conceptual or logical abstraction is a reflex response to the abstraction of the law which objectively dominates society. This could be shown in Beckett's works. These enjoy what is today the only human respectable fame. Everyone shudders at them, and yet no one can persuade himself that these eccentric plays and novels are not about what everyone knows, but no one will admit. Philosophical apologists may laud his work as sketches for an anthropology, but they deal with a highly concrete historical reality, the abdication of the subject. Beckett's Ecce Homo is what human beings have become, as so their eyes trained of tears, they stare silently out of his sentences. The spell they cast, which also binds them, is lifted by being reflected in them. However, the minimal promise of happiness they contain, which refuses to be traded for comfort, cannot be had for a price less than total dislocation to the point of worldlessness. Here, every commitment to the world must be abandoned to satisfy the ideal of the committed work of art, that polemical alienation which Brecht as a theorist invented and as an artist practiced less and less as he bound himself more tightly to the role of a friend of mankind. This paradox, which might be charged with sophistry, can be supported without any philosophy by the simplest experience. Kafka's prose and Beckett's play, or the truly monstrous novel, The Unnameable, have an effect by comparison with which officially committed works look like pantomime. Kafka and Beckett arouse the fear which existentialism merely talks about. By dismantling appearances, they explode from within the art which committed proclamation subjugates from without and hence only in appearance. Page 315. The inescapability of their Rorik compels the change of attitude, which committed Rorik's merely demand. He over from Kafka wheels. What have passed has lost forever both any peace with the world and any change of consoling himself with the judgment that the way of the world is bad. The element of ratification which lurks in resigned admission of the dominance of evil is burned away. Yet, the greater the aspiration, the greater is the possibility of foundering and failure. The laws of tension evident in works of painting and music, which have moved away from objective representation and intelligible or coherent meaning, has in many ways spread to the literature known in a repellent jargon as texts. Such works drift off the brink of indifference, degenerate insensibly into mere hobbies, into idle repetition of formulas now abandoned in other art forms, into trivial patterns. It is this development which often gives substance to crude calls for commitment, formal structures which challenge the lying positivism of meaning can easily slide into a different sort of vacuity. Positivistic arrangements, empty juggling with elements, they fall within the very sphere of they seek to escape. The extreme case of literature, which undialectically confuses itself with science and vainly tries to fuse with cybernetics. Extremes meet. What cuts the last thread of communication becomes the prey of communication theory. No firm criterion can draw the line between the determinate negation of meaning and a bad positivism of meaninglessness, as an assiduous soldiering on just for the sake of it. Least of all can such a line be based on an appeal to the human and a curse on mechanization. Works of art with their existence take the side of the victims of a rationality that subjugates nature, are even in their protest constitutively implicated in the process of rationalization itself. Were they to try to disown it, they would become both aesthetically and socially powerless mere clay. The organizing, unifying principle of each and every work of art is borrowed from that very rationality whose claim of totality it seeks to defy. French and German cultural traditions. In the history of French and German consciousness, the problem of commitment has been posed in opposite ways. In France, aesthetics have been dominated openly or covertly by the principles of l'art pour l'art, allied to academic and reactionary tendencies. Footnote 9, text. This explains the revolt against it. Even extreme avant-garde works have a touch of decorative allure in France. It is for this reason that the call to existence and commitment sounded revolutionary there. Page 316. In Germany, the situation is on the other way around. The liberation of art from any external end. Also, it was a German who first raised it poorly and incorruptibly into a criterion of taste, has always been suspect to a tradition which has deep roots in German idealism. The first famous document of this tradition is that senior master's Bible of intellectual history, Schiller's treatise on the theater as a moral institution. Such suspicion is not so much due to the elevation of mind to an absolute that is coupled with it, an attitude that swaggered its way into hubris in German philosophy. It is rather provoked by the sight that any work of art free of an ulterior goal shows to society. For this art is a reminder of that sensuous pleasure in which even, indeed, especially the most extreme dissonance by sublimation and negation partakes. German speculative philosophy granted that a work of art contains within itself the source of its transcendence, and that its own sum is always more than it, but only therefore to demand a certificate of good behavior from it. According to his latent tradition, a work of art should have not being for itself, since otherwise it would, as Plato's embryonic state socialism classically stigmatized it, be a source of effeminacy and an obstacle to action for its own sake. The German original sin. Killjoys, aesthetics, moralists of their sort, who are always invoking names like Luther and Bismarck, have no time for aesthetic autonomy. And there is also an undercurrent of servile heteronomy in the pathos of categorical imperative, which is indeed, on the one hand, reason itself, but on the other, a prude datum to be blindly obeyed. 50 years of Stefan George and his school were still being attacked as Frenchifying estates. Today the curmudgeons, whom no bombs could demolish, have allied themselves with the Philistines, who rage against the alleged incomprehensibility of the new art. The underlying impulse of these attacks is pretty bourgeois hatred of sex. The common ground of Western moralists and ideologists of socialist realism. No moral terror can prevent the sight of the work of art shown its beholder from giving him pleasure, even if only in the formal act of temporary freedom from the compulsion of practical goals. Thomas Mann called this quality of art high spirits, a notion intolerable to people with morals. Brecht himself, who was not without aesthetic traits, which reappear transmitted in the reserve of any great autonomous art towards consumption. Highly ridiculed culinary art, but he was much too intelligent not to know that pleasure can never be completely ignored in the total aesthetic effect, no matter how relentless the work. Page 317. The primacy of the aesthetic object as pure refulgoration does not smuggle consumption or false harmony back by a detour. Also, the moment of pleasure, even when it is extirpated from the effect of a work, constantly returns to it. The principle that governs autonomous work of art is not the totality of their effects, but their own inherent structure. They are knowledge as non-conceptual objects. This is the source of their greatness. It is not something of which they have to persuade men because it should be given to them. This is why today's autonomous rather than committed work of art should be encouraged in Germany. Committed works all too readily credit themselves with every noble value and then manipulate them into their at their ease. Under fascism, too, no atrocity was perpetrated without a moral veneer. Those who trumpet their ethics and humanity in Germany today are merely waiting for a chance to persecute those whom their rules condemn and to exercise the same inhumanity in practice of which they accuse modern art in theory. In Germany, commitment often means pleading what everyone is already saying, or at least secretly wants to hear. The notion of a message in art, even when politically radical, already contains an accommodation of the world. The stance of the lecturer conceals a clandestine entente with the listeners, who could only be truly rescued from illusions by refusal of it. The politics of autonomous art. The type of literature that, in accordance with the tenets of commitment, but also with the demands of Philistine moralism, exists for man, betrays him by traducing that which alone could help him. If it did not strike,